Hey, I'm James. Welcome to Alternate Sides, a podcast about movies, parking, and a 25-year friendship. It's all magic hour today as we talk about Terrence Malick's luminous period drama, Days of Heaven, starring Richard Gere, Brooke Adams, and Sam Shepard. As you listen, picture our voices suffused with a mellow amber glow. Along the way, we also talk about empty nests, changing sympathies, and the time Sam's aunt wouldn't stop filling my plate. Here we go.
Morning.
Yeah, all right. So what the hell? So you overslept.
I overslept a little. It's Eid al-Fitr if you're an Arab, or Eid al-Fitr if you're Iranian.
I'm neither of those, and this has as little bearing on your life as mine.
Well, I also have not been, what's the word I'm looking for, observing Ramadan. Mm. My son is off school today, and he's our 7 a.m. alarm clock. And so he didn't need to put an alarm on, so then we didn't need to wake up, and so I didn't.
I can't sleep in, even if I want to sleep in.
Of course you can't.
What do you mean, of course I can't?
Of course you can't. It goes with your entire characteristics of being insane.
I must object to the characterization, but I can't sleep in. For example, this won't surprise you, but if I woke up at like 9:30 in the morning one day, I would be so upset.
Well, that's your problem right there.
Yeah. I would feel like the day had been wasted already.
I can almost guarantee that tomorrow I will wake up at 9:30. 9:30. Delicious. Saturday. Lovely.
You love to sleep.
Oh, I love sleeping in. It's the best.
No, I can't do it. Do you know what I like? And I really do mean this. I love in the winter getting up in the dark before anyone else and padding around in the house in the dark, making my coffee, and it's nice and quiet. No one's busting my chops.
Awful. There's only 1:04 or 1:05 in the day. I've always said that.
1:04. Yeah, I don't get up at 5. I used to get up at 5 for a little while, but
I'll
get up at 6. 6 is a reasonable hour to get up. That's when you need to get up and muck the stables. And
I'm a 2 to 10. 2 a.m. to 10 a.m. That would be my
God.
Hours.
No.
If you leave me alone, that's what I end up doing. 2 to 10.
I'd probably do 9 to 5 or 10 to 6. Nothing good happens after 10 p.m.
Everything good. Nothing good happens before 10 p.m.
No. And we've discussed this before, but the idea of like going to a show now where there's an opening act and da-da-da-da, and the people you came to see don't get on stage till 9:30 or whatever. I don't like that.
You with your early bird dinner.
That's what I want. Yeah, I want a nice piece of fish at 5:30, and then I want the show to start at 6 and in bed by 9.
God, I'm glad we don't live in the same place.
Now, I'm going to have an opportunity to explore these
early bird dinners,
because there is a change coming up, which it's preoccupying me more and more, which is that I'm going to be an empty nester, my wife and I, pretty soon.
Mm, you won't have to worry about anyone bothering you in the mornings. You can wake up at 9.
No, that's a thing. No. I don't want that.
See, now you like being bothered.
I like the idea that I could be bothered, but I'm not being bothered. That's what I like. No, it's going to be lonely. And then, you know, my wife is going to work and she's going to go on some movie. This will be the interesting thing to see whether she's suddenly like, I'm taking a job in South Africa for 18 months.
I've decided.
It will be clear who she was really hanging around for.
I don't think you want to test that one too hard.
Yeah.
My sister used to say, when we were kids, she used to say that the best thing is when I'm watching TV in the TV room, but I know that, and you guys aren't there, so I can watch whatever I want, but I know that you guys are in the other room.
Yeah, that's nice.
She said that was her idea of like comfort. Yeah, I always thought that was very sweet.
She has some wonderful ideas. I haven't seen your sister in a few years, but her, occasionally when I'm brushing my teeth, I think about her her idea about toothbrushes, which makes me uneasy.
Yeah, toothbrushes being in the room where everyone poos. And so the waft of poo, just clouds of poo circling the head of the toothbrush.
which must be some kind of particulate matter, right? And some microscopic level, our toothbrushes are all coated in feces. systems. The family is a system, and it's about to be disrupted. And it's going to be a while before we find homeostasis.
Well, in a way, you've done your job, right? You've done it. It's all over now.
Well,
I mean, not all over for you, but all over for that unit. That unit will only be together for holidays.
But that unit has been together for 16 years now.
I know, but the essence of that unit is that it must dissolve.
No, I don't like it.
I know, no one likes it. Well, it's funny because we've always been on the other side of it, right? We were the ones who left. We were the ones who ran away, and now we're the ones being left.
Yes, my brother-in-law's dear late lamented father used to say that parenthood is a series of separations.
Yeah, that's very good.
I don't like that either. What's your friend's theory of group dynamics or something?
Andy Fitch's law of group dynamics. Within the group, all eventualities get spread so that they're to a certain degree. So for instance, if you're three people are in the woods, and if one person is terrified, then the other two can afford to be less terrified. They will be emboldened by this. But if that one who is terrified suddenly, for whatever reason, gains some sort of confidence and decides, actually, it's fine, one of the others will then take on the role of terrified because there has to be that level at all times.
Yeah, so the system of the family is going to be disrupted.
Most definitely.
I don't know if I've mentioned to you this notion of the identified patient, so-called, which is a role that I think I've occupied in my family of origin, which is that there's a kind of unconscious agreement in the group that one person will be the scapegoat or the person who, like, through whom all of the family's conflicts are enacted.
Right, right, right.
So I sort of realized this, you know, being like, hey, James, why don't you ruin another holiday? You know, that kind of thing. But also, what I think I realized a couple of years ago at a Christmas was that not only was everyone just kind of waiting for the moment when I would lose my temper with my mother, and there would be this sort of catharsis, but I actually felt that my sisters unconsciously were sort of goading me into it.
They needed it.
Like the tension had built to a certain point, and I wasn't taking the bait. And so they
it's
needed
not satisfying
to release the tension. So let's talk about this movie. And also, I mean, perhaps these themes might come up through the movie.
Perhaps.
Days of Heaven, Terry Malick, 1978.
What, Terry?
Set in, I think, 1916 or so, out in the Texas Panhandle. And
is it
young,
Texas?
I think so, yeah. Young Richard Gere.
Very young.
Is with his little sister, who narrates the film, amazing voice. Her accent and voice is this sort of Brooklyn or something, or like... It's really
Chicago, I guess, is the idea.
But... I guess it is Chicago, yeah. And so, yeah, they basically are wandering. It's Richard Gere and his little sister, and then Richard Gere's girlfriend, who they pretend is his other sister, so as not to arouse gossip.
Now, do they do that because it was a bit unclear to me? Do they do that because they're not married, and it's like it's a bit shit?
I guess so.
Because that's sort of the hinge that the whole film relies on. And it's just kind of like, well, you know, we did that just so that, you know, because people talk.
Right, people talk.
I mean, why couldn't they have just said they were married? And then one's going to say, where's your marriage certificate?
I don't know. Shall we get Terry on the phone? And
maybe. I think it's a very... it speaks to something in the film, which is that it's a very... a lot of things are elided, like... He doesn't go into detail about stuff. Everything,
which I love, and I was actually going to mention that so many of the scenes, you come in very late in the scene, or you only hear one line, like just sorry, and that's all you need to hear. Like, you know, it's pretty amazing how you can do that.
Well, so I think the truth is that he wrote all those scenes out, and they acted all those scenes out, and then he just cut them all out.
Well, apparently there was, took him 2 years to edit. And in fact, another Richard Gere movie, was it American Gigolo or something?
I know the one.
Shot and edited and released during the time that Terrence Malick was just editing this movie. But anyway, they're down in Texas and they're sort of seasonal migrant workers on this farm of this shy and very handsome young Sam Shepard.
Mm, dashing Texas landowner.
Sort of reclusive and who falls for Pierre's girlfriend. And a triangle ensues. I guess the hinge, this isn't really spoilery, but they gear and somewhat reluctantly his girlfriend agree that she's going to become the wife of the Sam Shepard
character. He takes an interest in the Brooke Adams character. Hmm. And then
when we find out that Sam Shepard has been diagnosed with some kind of terminal illness. So the idea is that she's going to marry him. And Sam Shepard will very shortly expire, and then they'll come into the estate. Mm. But of course, it doesn't quite work out the way, like with Stroshek, it doesn't quite work out the way that people plan.
She resuscitates him somehow.
She's really marvelous, and I didn't realize until after the film that in real life, she is Mrs. Tony Shalhoub.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was beautiful, and I realized as I was watching it, two things. As soon as it starts, of course, it's incredibly beautiful. Yeah. And it was just such a strong departure from Stroshek and from Rocky and the other movies. Yeah. And I wondered whether you would think that, like, I don't know, there's something about that like 70s grittiness that we talked about before. And then suddenly there's this kind of luminous, like magic hour sunset, wheat fields swaying in the wind. I wonder if that seems like somehow cheap to you, or that there is too pretty in a way.
Well, no, I don't think so. I it's definitely, it's like the anti-Stroshek, this movie. I agree. It's all filmed like at magic hour for 20 minutes a day, and it's breathtaking. The kind of the sequences, everything's bathed in this like lovely orange glow. It is extraordinary to look at.
Waiting for the butt. Mm-hmm.
This is the era of like the great DP. I mean, actually Haskell Wexler is like additional cinematography on this. Mm-hmm. You know, these are the days of Nestor Almendros and Conrad Hall and Gordy Willis, like these kind of guys who took over the look of a film.
Also, and Jack Fisk, production designer.
Jack Fisk. He must have been pretty young. But I would actually say that if like especially at the beginning of the movie, the sequence in Chicago and a lot of the stuff in the fields, it's not done in this kind of classic techno crane gorgeous composition. Mm-hmm. The lighting, I mean, is, you know, they always say God is the gaffer. They didn't light it. They just let it be you know, the sun. But the camera movements, the camera is very intimate. It's got this like, it does have that 70s.
Well, apparently Wexler shot the Chicago scenes and the handheld scenes, apparently.
So there you go. Nestor did the crane shots. Yeah. And Wexler, I didn't know that. Wexler, who's famously kind of cool dude, made a film called Medium Cool. That stuff felt very much of the 70s. And it felt like a different way, like it felt like a way to take the way that Hal Ashby or Herzog might use the camera handheld, but insist on it being at 6:45 p.m. Why don't I love this movie? Why doesn't it, like, why don't I really love it? And I think it's because it's ultimately, it all hangs out on the surface, all that look and all that stuff. And all the sort of sparsity of words and any kind of dialogue and any kind of thing, it doesn't reveal anything about these people. It doesn't show me something really surprising. Like the moment when they agree to, when Richard Gere agrees to the terms, is a moment of interest, because like you're like, oh, I didn't necessarily think he would go along with this so easily. You see something, for once we see some character, something underneath the surface of handsome, beautiful worker.
Yeah. Well, you can imagine the the Bergman version of this setup.
Exactly.
Yeah, which would totally be so intense. And
exactly.
But I think Ebert I read last night as I was falling asleep that Ebert in the 90s did a sort of reappraisal and said, you know, really it's the story of the little sister. It's like her POV, she's the narrator or whatever. And maybe seeing these things from that kind of remove is a sort of intentional choice. But I agree that it doesn't quite.
And also wasn't, I think, if I'm not mistaken, that whole voiceover was like an editing solution, right? It wasn't in the script. So again, it's like, yeah, that's true, but that's not necessarily the move. It was a solve for the movie. I think the voiceover, which also is a very Malick thing, all this violence, you know, like that's he lives with that forever and ever and ever.
I wrote down part of the voiceover, which I really liked. She says, "I got to like this farm." Well, you always have to imagine in her accent, which is so incredible. Yeah. "I got to like this farm, do anything I want, roll in the fields, talk to the wheat patches. When I was sleeping, they'd talk to me. They'd go in my dreams."
Yeah.
So that with like the sunset, and like the grass, close up like the grasshopper on like gorgeous. A head of cabbage or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you can also imagine that if he'd had that idea to begin with, like I think he would have made that movie. Mm-hmm. And it would have actually, we would have seen her dreams and we would have lived, we would have watched this relationship unfold through her eyes. But it's not shot that way.
Yeah.
We see her as another participant rather than.
It's almost like the movie is written and shot as though it's going to be this sort of Bergman-esque drama, and then they realize it doesn't work, and so they try in the editing room make it into this other thing.
They turn it into her view, but we haven't shot it from her POV.
Right. And then Malick, so reviews are mixed. It makes a little money. People comment, you know, it's beautiful. Everyone acknowledges that. But then Malick doesn't make another movie for like 20 years.
20 years.
So The Thin Red Line, which I love.
The thing is, I mean, Malick is a genius of scenes. Like the scene in The Thin Red Line, holy shit, there's a couple of them, but that one scene when they storm that village and the Zimmer score comes up.
And all the smoke.
I got goosebumps just thinking about it. It is, I mean, it's what every time that movie's on TV, when I used to watch it, every time you turn the movie on, it was always about to be that scene. And I was like, oh God, I got to watch it. And it's just, it really is one of the most extraordinary scenes. I mean, this too, the music in this, which is it Ennio Morricone or is it Saint-Saëns? I can't quite understand. Like it's
a bit of both. And then the guitar stuff is Leo Kottke, who's still around. Oh, in fact, Leo Kottke and Dave King have an album coming out this year.
Oh, really?
Easily enough, yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
There's something else I noticed about just the way that we write. I mean, I don't mean you and I specifically, but I mean like, you know, writing stories, writing drama, is that you instinctively somehow side with Richard Gere in the beginning, even though the first thing you see him is him killing man. He like loses his temper and like kills this foreman in the Chicago factory and then goes.
Oh, does he kill him? I didn't get that he killed him.
Well,
he beats him up.
Well, part of it, I guess, is the voiceover. The voiceover of the little girl saying, "My brother, he used to juggle apples," or whatever, you know, like he was funny. Right. He would look after me, you know, that kind of thing. And so
he's got a temper.
He's got a temper, but we attach ourselves to him. And they go to this farm. And then Sam Shepard is this kind of aloof character. He's sort of mysterious. And he's obviously going to be like the trouble. Like he's going to be the source of whatever trouble comes to this. But then, you know, maybe 20 minutes into the movie or whatever, you overhear Sam Shepard talking to his doctor and you realize he's only got a year to live or whatever. And I suddenly found myself being like, aww. Like I feel bad for that guy now. Suddenly I want him to be okay, you know? So I guess it's sort of cheap if you use it in a certain way, but I definitely felt my allegiance shift slightly as that happened. I was thinking, by the way, of Richard, of the Steve Coogan's Richard Gere.
Joshua.
Which is done in this. He does that a couple of times.
But this is before Richard Gere became Richard Gere as well.
Hmm.
Like this, is this like his first movie or his, I mean, it's got to be early on.
Yeah, I don't know.
Right? I don't think he'd done very much.
I'm not really a gear guy.
No, I don't. I mean, I don't think, is anyone? I can't imagine anyone going, I fucking love Richard Gere, man.
Well, maybe that's it. There's a sort of blankness to him. I did see him in, was it Arbitrage, that movie from maybe 10 years ago, which I thought was pretty good.
He's a very, you know, he was a handsome leading man, right? My aunt loved it. My aunt thought he was the most handsome man ever. Oh, Richard Gere. Oh, Shishan. She loved him so much. Summersby. The movie she loved was Summersby. We still say to this day, oh, she watched that. She got to the end of that movie. And she just, me and my sister caught her in this moment. This is when she used to live with us. And we caught her in this moment. It was a VCR. So she'd rewound the tape. We had to give it back to the video shop. She'd rewound it and she just took it out of the video, the VCR. And she was putting it away and she looked at it and she went, oh, Summersby. And then me and my sister just start laughing. And she looks around and goes, here, you guys are there. And we just caught her in this like intimate moment with Richard Gere. And I remember thinking, that movie was so shit. But she loved it because she had the hots for Richard Gere. She's very sweet. Mm. You met my aunt. That's the one you met.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
She kept trying to feed you everything in the house. Mm-hmm. And you out of politeness, I think, kept accepting.
Well, I never know what I'm supposed to. I feel like I get it wrong no matter what with this Toro. But, you know, am I supposed to accept or are they going to keep offering me until I thinking, look at this pig?
So I had to say to her, in Farsi, I was like, if you keep offering, he's just going to keep accepting. And she was like, oh, okay. I just thought he was really hungry.
Well, I it's no secret that I love to eat, but.
Yeah, bro, it's funny. Summersby. We still say that to this day. It's funny. Mm. Yeah. I don't know what else to say about that movie, really. Lovely movie. Not my favorite movie.
Mm.
It's beautiful when the horses have snow on them. And there's that one scene, the snow, like frost, light frost and snow comes. It's really beautiful.
And when the train comes and they're all getting on the train to go north at the end.
To leave. It's fantastic. Yeah. It has a kind of like an epic quality to it.
Also when the harvest comes in and then the last bale is done and everyone celebrates and the tractors do their horns and then they have like a little hoedown kind of thing.
There's something very like classical about it, right? There's something, I was going to bring up Virgil's eclogues, but that's probably a bit too.
I think it's too late for you to pretend that you're not a douchebag. So you may as well just go right ahead.
Virgil's eclogue, which I'm sure you're familiar with, his pastoral poem predating the Aeneid. It's all about that. It's all about the celebration of the land and the people who work the land and the fields and the joy of it. I should go back and read them again. I was reading, I think Daniel Mendelssohn's got a new translation of the Odyssey coming out, and they excerpted a part of it. Part of it. Did you see that? Very good. It was very, very good. I was thinking I could give that another look.
Emily Wilson, who is the most recent high-profile Odyssey translator, this is maybe 3-4 years ago, one of the only female translators of Homer, was a contemporary of mine in graduate school. I remember her well.
Oh, really?
She was very nice. Yeah, classics, PhD student in classics when I was getting my first master's degree. What do you think about that? Speaking of douchebags. Okay. Well, what do you think? Should we get to next year's movies?
I guess so.
Movies from 1979 that I have not seen. Now, I have to say, 1979 is a powerhouse year. Let me just run down some of the movies that I have seen from that year. Apocalypse Now, Manhattan, The Jerk, The Muppet Movie, The China Syndrome, which I saw for the first time this year, which is quite good. The Black Stallion. Star Trek, the motion picture.
Oh.
And a little movie called Stalker by Tarkovsky. The Black Stallion, Molly and I watched that a couple months ago. For some reason, I saw that it was going to be on, and I turned it on because it has a beautiful theme, music theme written by Carmine Coppola, who I think is Francis's uncle.
Right.
And they had a bit, sort of a hint, an allusion to this beautiful theme in the opening credits. And I was watching the movie waiting for like the big da-dee-da-dee-da-dee-da-da. And it doesn't appear again until the closing credits.
That's it. That's all you get.
That's it. Yeah, so okay, movies from 1979 I haven't seen. Alien.
Wow. Never seen Alien?
No, and the reason is because it's there are not many there are some movies that I remember my dad liking when I was a kid, but Alien was the one movie that I remember him saying was terrifying. That he went to go see it in the theater and it really it really did a number on him. And I just remember him being like dead-eyed, just being like, that movie is so upsetting. So it's always figured like loomed large in my mind. Oh, yeah. And at this point, you know, I don't know if it's like Rocky in that kind of like, I kind of know the contours of the movie. I've seen the scene where the thing comes out of the stomach. I know what the alien looks like and da 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 da.
So yeah.
I wonder if it's actually how illuminating it would be.
It definitely won't scare you the way it scared your dad.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember people saying that was a shocking movie.
Mm. Mad Max.
No, the Mel Gibson.
The original before the War Road Warrior. Yeah.
It's very lo-fi. I mean, it'd be comical to watch that.
That also is a movie I was it won't surprise you to learn, afraid to watch when I was a kid. I had classmates who were like, Mad Max, rah. And I was like, well, I don't want to watch that. Is that people hurting each other? Is that they're in cars?
Yeah, that's about it. The new Mad Max. Did you see that?
I have not seen it. I want to see it.
The new that's Mad the Max one with
what's his name and what's his name? Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron. Yeah.
It's extraordinary. Yeah. Absolutely amazing.
That's
same
a movie
guy, right?
Yeah. That's a movie I'd want to see in the theater. Kramer versus Kramer.
You've never seen Kramer versus Kramer. What the fuck is wrong with you?
Too scary.
Oh my God. They're all too scary. I love it. Kramer versus Kramer is, oh my God. This is going to be hard to choose.
Yeah, this is a good year. I like that we're getting into the movies now that I like remember coming out or that I, you know, that.
coming out and I remember avoiding.
Yeah. Kramer versus Kramer. I suspect that's a movie that's amazing, obviously amazingly acted, Dustin Hoffman and Meryl Streep. But I wonder if that's like, you know, sort of with Days of Heaven, like the performance of it is somehow like more captivating than like the heart of the story or whatever, if you see what I mean.
Like, I saw Kramer versus Kramer again, like not maybe, I don't know, like 3-4 years ago. I think Margie and I watched it. I don't know why we just watched it. And we were blown away. I mean, the ending of it is, it's just one of the great endings.
All right. Well, so let's okay. So this is a good year. You ready? Okay. Here's another one. Being There.
Being There?
Yeah. Peter Sellers' final movie, Hal Ashby.
Woo. You've not seen that? What the fuck? That's not too scary.
Well, to be totally fair, I think I saw Being There when it came out. I was 6. So...
Yeah, no, you have to see it later.
Yeah, so I don't...
Chauncey Gardner. Yeah. That's an incredible movie. I mean, we have done a Hal Ashby movie.
Yeah.
I guess I didn't know that you hadn't seen Being There. I might have saved it.
Well, we'll see. Okay, then there are a couple of here that are sort of more, you might say, second-tier movies. Escape from Alcatraz.
The Clint Eastwood?
I think so, yeah.
I loved that movie when I was a kid. Oh my God, it's so exciting. It's not, I wouldn't recommend it for our watching, but it's just, it was like so, so exciting.
Yeah. I think my dad liked that movie.
It's such a good movie. Yeah.
Yeah. Here's an interesting one. My Brilliant Career.
I don't think I know that movie.
I only mention it because it's a favorite movie by our dear friend, Cynthia Hopkins. It's one of her favorite movies. It's an Australian movie directed by Gillian Armstrong. With Judy Davis and Sam Neill.
Yes. Yeah, I think it was like on Criterion recently. I've not seen it. But if Cynthia says we should watch it, we should probably watch it.
We probably should. Monty Python's Life of Brian.
You've never seen Life of Brian?
No.
And the fact that you think that that's second tier, I would put them easily in the first tier. Oh my God. That is shocking. What's the reason for that then?
Part of it is like when I was young, like, I don't know, like 8 or 10, I went to our neighbor's house and they were raving about this hilarious movie. And it was the Holy Grail. And I watched it and I just found it so dumb, boring, like not funny at all. I didn't get it. I think.
Yeah.
But then it was like, oh, those guys, you know, like, I don't want to see The Life of Brian. Yeah, just like, there's something about that period of English culture also that's like so kind of gives me the heebie-jeebies a little bit. Last one. All That Jazz.
Wow.
Bob Fosse.
That's good too. You could actually get me to watch a musical.
Roy Scheider.
It's like one of the few musicals I'm willing to watch. Well, this is crazy. This first of all, this is embarrassing that you haven't seen these.
Yes. Speaking of all that jazz and musicals, I'm not going to do the thing. I mean, I love to hear a good Somnive rant, but some other time we'll talk about musicals and why you think that people's love of musicals is a conspiracy.
Mm.
Like people's love of Candy Crush. Yeah, so what do you think? I would say the top three would be Kramer versus Kramer and Being There and maybe All That Jazz. You want me to run down the list again?
Yeah, this is very hard. This is the hardest one we've had to decide.
Alien.
Alien, let's knock off Mad Max, not Mad Max, but okay. Alien, because of your dad, I'm tempted.
Mm.
And because it's different. But I don't know. Okay. Alien. Yeah.
I miss him.
Yeah.
My dad. How long has it been? 28 years? Something like that?
Wow.
28 years. Okay.
Crazy.
Kramer versus Kramer. Being There. Escape from Alcatraz.
Not Escape from Alcatraz.
Okay. Not My Brilliant Career.
Well, why not My Brilliant Career? None of us know anything, and Cynthia says it's brilliant.
Well, it just seems like, since part of this is like the movies that a guy like me ought to have seen. I mean,
yeah, it's not on that level. Yeah,
it's more in the Stroshek than the Rocky.
Definitely,
as far as that is concerned. So another time, we'll just watch it. We'll watch it just for ourselves. Life of Brian, All That Jazz.
I don't know. Which would you vote for? You'd vote for Kramer?
Well, I mean, there's a little bit of I could throw a super curveball, which is to actually watch two of them and then just talk about one.
Or why not talk about two?
I guess so. I don't know.
Which two would be? You could do two comedies. You could do Being There and Life of Brian.
Mm.
Which are both like one, they're both satires.
Mm. That's true.
I would say let's watch Being There and Life of Brian.
Okay. Being There?
Let's watch Being There.
And Life of Brian. Okay, that'll be fun.
It'll be a comedy. A comedy double act.
Double feature.
Oh, crikey. It's 10 o'clock. I gotta go to the dentist this morning.
Oh, yeah.
Right after this. I gotta go there.
What's going to happen with the family? I don't like it. I really don't like it. And there's an uncertainty also that either, I don't know, it's, you don't realize, well, maybe you do, but you don't realize how much, like, it's the system. Once you become a parent, like, they're always there in the back of your mind. And like every little choice of like, from grocery shopping to like, you know, whatever, laundry, when you sleep, like everything is kind
maybe
of
it'll
like.
Maybe it'll be glorious.
Well, I don't know, because you know me and I get.
It won't be glorious at all.
Well, the thing is, like, I worked so hard to get to like inbox zero and finally have some free time. And then when I have the free time, invariably, I feel very unsettled and spooked. Mm. And I don't know what to do with myself.
You got to work on that.
Yeah.
Four men have just arrived right next to one is wiping the window of my car. I'm not sure why. Very funny. He just literally came over. There's four men, Muslim men, dressed in the long robes, each one a different color, a purple, a brown, because it's Eid al-Fitr. And one of them just walked over. I mean, my car is filthy, but but he just took a tissue out and wiped the side window.
That's it? And then they just kept walking?
No, they're just standing there.
Why would he do that?
It's dirty.
Yeah, but what business is that of his?
He just saw a dirty car and thought I should clean that.
Did he see, acknowledge you or see you?
No, he doesn't know that I'm in the car.
Oh.
They have no idea. They're just hanging out. Just
maybe laughing. It was dirty and somebody had like written something untoward.
No. I could see what he's doing. I think he just was like looking at it. It was like I don't even think he knew he was doing it. It was one of those things. He just took a tissue out and wiped it and then threw the tissue in the street.
That's very strange.
That's what you do. Maybe for aid, everything has to be clean.
They're still standing there? They're just standing
They're standing there. They're all looking at one guy's phone. One guy's got a phone, and the other three are all peering over his shoulder. I think they're wondering where they should go for the big celebration. Where do we go, guys? Where do we go? We've been waiting for this for a month. We've been starving for a fucking month. Mm. Where do we go? All right, I gotta go.
All right, so enjoy the dentist, being there, and Life of Brian. And that'll be good, double feature.
Love it.
All right.
All right. Cheers.
See you soon.
Bye.
And that's that. Next week, it's a double feature. Hal Ashby's American satire, Being There, and Monty Python's biblical spoof, Life of Brian. In a way, they're both about the same thing, or so it seems to me. Check them out if you have a chance. See you next time.